Hello everyone, my name's Kate Cooper. I'm Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute of Leadership and Management. And today I'm delighted to be joined by our new Chief Executive, John Mark Williams, in our weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at what's been happening in the world of leadership and management up to the 28th of September 2020. Hello, John.
Good morning. Hi.
First one, we're looking at, do female boards seat targets enable meritocracy?
Evidence that targets are tangibly boosting female inclusion has appeared in the latest female FTSE board report from Cranfield School of Management, putting the FTSE 350 as a whole on track to reach the Hampton-Alexander goal of 33% by the end of the year. Most FTSE firms adopted voluntary targets, and there's been little resistance in the UK to gender targets. Some firms have sometimes used more ambitious aims as a means of galvanising their HR systems. Cranfield's Professor of Women and Leadership, Sue Vinnicum, highlighted the recent focus on flexible working and wellbeing as an opportunity to progress the diversity agenda. Co-author Eleanor Doldor of Queen Mary University London commented that targets don't threaten meritocracy, they enable it.
So, John, do you support Eleanor Doldor's assessment that targets can support meritocratic decision making?
Great question, Kate. Great question. I think the answer is in the word meritocracy. Eleanor's actual comment was targets don't threaten meritocracy, they enable it. And I think actually there are people who would interpret that word enable to be force. Targets force meritocracy. And I think in situations where meritocracy has not been the basis for people's progress, which has been the case in terms of diversity and inclusion, then actually a meritocracy does need to be forced, because the meritocracy by definition is an arena in which people progress on merit. So I think at the top end of organizations, whilst there is a view that a measure is a good thing as long as it doesn't become a target, I would nevertheless be in favor of some pretty clear measures and some pretty clear targets for displaying diversity and inclusion. Slightly more important issue here, I think, is that actually we're talking about the top end of large organizations, executive and non-exec directors. For me, a much more important issue is, I suppose, less the glass ceiling than the fact that the ladder is broken. One of the reasons why we have not seen far more women in position to pitch for senior positions in all organizations is that actually the ladder doesn't, or the break in the ladder doesn't allow women to move up the organizations, if I can describe it like moving up, in the way that other people can. And I think that addressing where the ladder is broken will produce in the long term, a much more effective diversity and inclusion outcome than solely targeting at the top of organisations.
So now we've got to consider, what has the UK response to COVID told us about followership?
UK residents' behaviour in the first phase of lockdown shows that clear leadership is key to social responsibility, according to a Guardian column by Nikki Hawkins. For 3 months back in the spring, she wrote, "We UK citizens did what we needed to do. We acted collectively by staying at home to save lives." She cites a piece of late April research from the LSE indicating that broadly, people complied with the initial lockdown requirements by consent rather than compulsion, compelled by our feelings of social responsibility and our perception of what others were doing, our sense of what was normal. Fear for ourselves is not the primary driver of our actions. We act with and for each other, based on our sense of what's right and what we think other people are doing. We stuck to lockdown because we believed other people were sticking to it. 9 out of 10 of us in the UK are wearing face coverings. Doing the right thing by each other is very much the norm.
Are there lessons here for leaders to learn?
Most definitely. As a country, yes, of course, government is essentially driven by consent rather than merely compliance when we're talking about the whole population. And we've demonstrated, I think, in the UK, a culture of not just consent or compliance, actually almost a collectivist culture. People have demonstrated that actually they care about each other as much as they do about themselves. One of the vital things in this, and I think this is the lesson for leadership, is that role modeling of the behaviours that we want to see becomes a crucial function for leaders. And particularly when we're talking about something at this scale, where public figures have a responsibility to role model the behaviours that they want to see from the population. And one of the challenges I think that we've seen, not just in the UK, but in other countries as well, is the degree to which public figures, particularly those in leadership roles, have actually been prepared to role model the behaviours that actually they wanted to see the rest of us use. So I think that idea of role modelling what we really want other people to do is the most important lesson that I've seen come out of this for leaders.
Exciting story here from the Deutsche Börse, which will see the biggest spin-off in the history of the German stock exchange this week, because Siemens is listing its energy unit, Siemens Energy, valued at about 23 billion euros. And the engineering giant is giving 55% of the equity to its investors at a ratio of 1-for-2 Siemens shares. Turning Siemens Energy business into an independent company is a key milestone in the successful execution of our Vision 2020 Plus strategy program, said Joe Kaiser, president and CEO of Siemens AG. Global energy markets are undergoing a fundamental change, added Christian Bruch, CEO of Siemens Energy AG. While demand is constantly rising, we need to cut carbon emissions radically. This is a challenge, but above all, an opportunity. With Siemens Energy, we're creating an integrated energy company that offers solutions and can support customers in all segments of the value chain. John, is this an example of Siemens sticking to the knitting, to quote that old maxim from Peters and Waterman?
It's very interesting, Kate, because of course Siemens is a vast multinational conglomerate with close to 100 billion in turnover, and it's knitting is actually a pretty broad concept in a lot of ways. Health, digital mobility, industrial automation, smart infrastructure, all of these things. However, what is very clear here is that Siemens have identified that the future, as they've said themselves, the future in global energy markets is changing, I think, fundamentally, really, and the shift to renewable energy sources is not a fad. It is not a short-term expedient. It is the long-term future of energy. And I think this is a case of Siemens identifying that there's a clear and easily defined future pathway for one of the major divisions within the company, and is saying, okay, this actually needs to stand on its own, really. And it also enables Siemens to focus, and coming back to that idea of sticking to the knitting, it actually allows Siemens to focus on a smaller number of other directions, smart infrastructure, industrial automation, medical diagnostics, etc., which reduces the amount of diffusion, if you like, in the core business.
Well, here's a good one, John.
Investment giant BlackRock, who last year fired senior executive Mark Wiseman for failing to disclose an affair with a colleague, is introducing new rules over office romances that extend to relationships outside the office in a bid to clamp down on conflicts of interest. BBC News reports that BlackRock staff were already expected to tell managers if they were dating one of their 16,000 colleagues, but the new policy says they must disclose relationships with external partners with a connection to the firm, an enormous network of hundreds of thousands of people. Hashtag MeToo movement highlighted that harassment takes place in a range of professional settings. But is this taking rules over office romances too far?
I think probably three things here, Kate. First one is that there's a reflection of consciousness in the world of work around this huge challenge that we've been brushing, I think, under the carpet for quite a long time around power imbalance and authority. And the Me Too movement is an inevitable response to the long-term injustices that have been, in a sense, in some organisations, normal behaviour for a very long time. So I think there's definitely that sign of the times element to this. And actually, it's absolutely right that organisations should respond to the way that society finally understands the way that society works. I think there's also an additional point here, and it's a technical one, and it doesn't detract in any way from the rightness in a social sense of the Me Too movement or anything else. However, BlackRock is also a financial services business, and they are subject to an enormously rigid regulatory framework, which is all around anti-money laundering, anti-bribery, and things like this. And compliance is a crucial element of the behavior of a financial services company. So if there is any kind of personal relationship which might in any way detract from the likelihood or the certainty, really, of an individual in a financial services company being completely above board in their behavior, then the company cannot allow it. So there is both a technical and an absolutely correct social reason why BlackRock should be concerned not solely about internal affairs, if I can call it that, affairs inside the organization, but also relationships with connected businesses outside the organization.
Oh, thank you ever so much, John. These have been really great stories, and your insights have been most welcome, most interesting. And to everybody, please do subscribe to the series and look forward to our podcast next week.